The long prophesied destruction of Israel and Judah had started to take place. Jim McGuigan remarks about this, "God asked the prophets and the righteous to do the impossible in times of coming disaster. And that impossible was this: trust fully in God's love. In the face of coming calamity, the gospel Habakkuk, the prophet, was given to preach in Habakkuk 2 and verse 4 was, the righteous shall live by faith. They would lose everything. They dare not lose faith. Everything they had known, many people that they had been around. There would be horrible things happen. The people had brought it on themselves, yes, but they would see sights that they had never seen before in the most awful of ways. It was not God's desire, but it was necessary punishment. The Assyrian Empire took over the kingdom of Israel. It was a large empire. It was powerful. It was vicious. But the Babylonian Empire took over the Assyrian Empire. It was even larger as it did so. And it then took the kingdom of Judah. In 605 BC, members of Judah's nobility were taken to Babylon, including Daniel and his friends that we read about in Daniel's writings. In 597 BC, King Jehoiakim, along with thousands of craftsmen, of smiths, chief officials, princes, and men of war, were taken to Babylon. In 586 BC, the temple in Jerusalem was entirely destroyed, hardly a stone left standing on another stone. And those few who were left there in that vicinity migrated to Egypt, including the prophet Jeremiah. Josephus says that more Jews were taken to Babylon in 582 BC. It's hard to imagine that any more could have been taken. There were very few left. The Jews remained in exile, though, for as long as the Babylonian Empire stood. The Assyrians and the Babylonians were well known for their policy of taking conquered peoples to a foreign land, to lands within their empire. The Jewish colonies were assigned suitable settlements throughout Babylonia, as prescribed by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia. But in time, the Jews spread out throughout the empire. It seems that those who had been taken by the Babylonians and taken into their lands and into their empire were the best and the brightest. They were people with valued skills, and so they put them where they could best use them. They were accorded favorable treatment. And so it was that God's people, who had been concentrated in a small area, relatively speaking, were now spread over a vast empire, an empire that was an ungodly empire. God intended that his people influence their new society, and he intended that so that that society would not influence them. The Jews were not a primitive people. We know that Solomon's temple was a marvel of its time. We know that people came from far and wide to hear of Solomon and to see his treasures and to see this marvelous temple, probably also to see his palace for that matter. And so the Jews were not a primitive people who were unfamiliar with things of grandeur and majesty. But what the Assyrians, in particular the Babylonians, had done in their society was well beyond anything that the Jews had seen or probably imagined. God had directed in advance of this through Jeremiah that his people understand what they were to do and how they were to conduct themselves in this new land. And so we read in Jeremiah chapter 29, beginning at verse 1, this is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles and to the priests, the prophets, and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. This was after King Jehoiakim and the queen mother, the court officials, and the leaders of Judah and Jerusalem, the craftsmen and the artisans, had gone into exile from Jerusalem. He entrusted the letter to Elasa, son of Shaphan, and to Gemariah, son of Hilkiah, whom Zedekiah, king of Judah, sent to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. It said, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant greens, gardens, and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Yes, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Do not let the prophets and diviners among you deceive you. Do not listen to the dreams you encourage them to have. They are prophesying lies to you in my name. I have not sent them, declares the Lord. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place. You might think that God would have a different message for his people. You might think that God would say to his people in exile, now your moment has come. Now you're amongst them. Now you have an opportunity to infiltrate them. Now I want you to get together at night and organize and create a rebellion and tear down this empire that has come and devastated you. I want you to destroy them completely, and I will go with you. And I will do to them as I did to those that were in the land of Canaan when you came in. But that's not the message. Instead, there is the message of settle down, go about life as usual, pray for the well-being of the city, make life its fullest, and do not listen to those who prophesy what you want to hear about a quick return in just 2 years to your land, because I've already prophesied it will be 70 years before you get to come back. The message of God to trust him fully, to have faith in him, was being established by God very well. During his long reign, Nebuchadnezzar devoted intensive efforts toward construction projects in Babylon. It's highly likely that these craftsmen, these highly skilled people that Nebuchadnezzar took out of Jerusalem and out of the surrounding area of Judah, were taken to work on some of these projects, along probably with skilled craftsmen from other countries, other nations that Nebuchadnezzar had overwhelmed. And so here they were, Jews working alongside peoples of other nations and of other beliefs, people who had other gods, people who had other ways of worshiping what they perceived to be God. Now they were in what we today call a pluralistic society, rather than a society that worshiped God only. Now they were in a place where they were put to work building something that did not honor their God, but that honored the king who saw himself as God. The beauty and majesty of Babylon's royal city, we're told, was unsurpassed in ancient times. One writer has said this: Babylon was defensively fortified by a moat and a double wall. Throughout the city, a vast system of streets and canals was built to facilitate transportation. It was a Venice of sorts. Along the broad processional street and in the palace were lions, bulls, and dragons made of colored enamel bricks. The noted Ishtar Gate marked the impressive entrance into this street. Bricks used in ordinary construction bore the imprint of Nebuchadnezzar's own name. Some 20 temples in Babylon and Borsippa are credited to this famous king. The outstanding undertaking in this in the temple area was the reconstruction of the ziggurat. And the ziggurat, as you probably know, is a kind of a pyramid. The hanging gardens built by Nebuchadnezzar to please his Median queen were regarded by the Greeks as one of the seven wonders of the world. The glory of the Babylonian kingdom began to fade with the death of Nebuchadnezzar in 562 BC. His marked success had enlarged the small kingdom of Babylon to span the Near East from Susa to the Mediterranean, from the Persian Gulf to the Upper Tigris, and from the Taurus Mountains down to the first cataract in Egypt. It was a large empire geographically. As an adventurous builder, he made the city of Babylon the mightiest fortress in the world, adorned with unsurpassed splendor and beauty. The power and genius that characterized his 43-year reign were never equaled by any of his successors. And so here, now, are the Israelites in this city and in this kingdom, in this empire. Not a small city-state, not even a small nation as Israel had been, but an empire in which a powerful king, a powerful soldier, a man with great vision, a man who desires to leave a permanent mark on the world, is busily at work doing that and involving them in it. Throughout the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel and his friends were given positions of importance. Daniel was next in command to the co-rulership of Belshazzar and Nabonidus. Here this foreigner, this Jew, this conquered person was placed in next to the top position for the rulership of this great empire. Daniel continued his distinctive government service under Darius the Mede and later Cyrus the Persian. When the Babylonian Empire was conquered by the Medo-Persians and yet a larger empire in 539 BC, the Jews were granted the privilege of reestablishing their national home in Palestine. The time of God's planning had come. This came by way of King Cyrus, or Cyrus the Great as he's sometimes known. He encouraged uprooted people to return to their homelands and restore their gods and their temples. And so it was that the Jews benefited by this. But Cyrus was a very smart politician. He realized that bringing people out of their home countries and bringing them into a place where they did not perceive that they could worship their gods because they thought their gods were limited to the lands, was a smart move. Put them back in their lands where they would be content. Otherwise, they would tend to bring up rebellions and would constantly keep his people at work just putting down internal rebellions. Although some of the Jews returned to rebuild the temple and rehabilitate Jerusalem, the Jewish state never regained completely independent status. Instead, it remained a province of the Persian Empire, and many Jews remained in exile, never to return to their native land. That would be true right up into modern times within the last century. The exiles from Jerusalem who were conscious of the reasons for their captivity must have experienced a deep sense of humiliation and anguish of their souls. They knew that this captivity, this disbursement into this great empire could have been prevented if only their kings, their nobles and their false prophets had returned to God. If only the people as a whole had humbled themselves to those many prophets that God sent. But now they were living the punishment that God had told them of. All we have to do to get a sense of how they felt was to read that short book in the Bible in the Old Testament called Lamentations. These laments, these cries, these anguished outbursts to God from his people, that really can be condensed down into one word: why? Why? In captivity, even Daniel prayed in Daniel chapter 9, acknowledging to God that his people had become a reproach and a byword, just as God had said that they would, a reproach and a byword to all the people surrounding them, everybody who knew anything at all about God's people. Cambyses succeeded his father Cyrus. He was followed by Darius I and then by Xerxes I. And we read that the fortunes of Esther at the Persian court of Xerxes I typify the treatment that was accorded the Jews by their overlords. Here this Jewess, again a captive person from a small, rather insignificant part of this empire, is called to be the queen of the emperor. Nehemiah served the royal court in a position of importance and trust to the king as the cupbearer to the king. There was no one with greater trust than in that role. The Jewish captives were not mistreated physically, nor were they suppressed in their religious and civic activities during the days of Babylonian supremacy. You know, sometimes we may think that the Jews in captivity were treated as slaves, that they had harsh taskmasters, much like what we see in the latter times that they were in Egypt. But that was not the case. They were not brought there to be forced slave labor. They were brought there to add their values to this great and growing kingdom. Actually, the Jews had been punished already by virtue of what happened within their land and within Jerusalem most specifically. The captivity served other purposes of God. Xerxes I was followed by Artaxerxes I. It was under his reign that Ezra and Nehemiah began to rebuild Jerusalem's walls and the altar and the temple of God. And then, later on, Alexander the Great broke Persian power and incorporated the Persian Empire into the even larger Greek Empire. In the past, the Jews had often been overtaken by their neighbors, the Philistines. But every time, just as we would read through Judges, they cried out to God and He had provided victory for them over their enemies. They had never been taken out of the land that God had promised to them as their inheritance. But now, they'd been taken to a distant land to be assimilated into a different culture. When we read the first chapter of Daniel, that really becomes crystal clear. Daniel was one of the best and the brightest, along with his close friends. They were brought in to be assimilated into that Babylonian culture, to be trained in all Babylonian culture, in language, in reading, in all that went with being a Babylonian through and through. And they were blessed by God to be able to serve, but they did not take on that whole culture by any means. The Jewish community in captivity intentionally staked out public liturgical space to reenact and to reclaim its own distinctive identity. Their liturgical acts were acts of faith in God. And it was in this time that, with the temple destroyed and God's people dispersed, that the synagogue was begun as a community center and a school and a place of worship. And those who would teach within it would come to be called rabbis. God had not commanded His people to develop synagogues, nor to appoint people to be rabbis. These were means or matters of expediency. They were means to keep the Jews together. They were means to train people, the whole community, in God's word and worship. And most importantly, they were means for the Jews to maintain their identity as God's covenant people. They were responses to the pagan society into which they had thrust themselves by their disobedience. One scholar has remarked that while it was true for the ancient Jews, it remains true for all Christians. The pressure of a universal identity is always a threat to a particular identity, so that assimilation is ever a clear and present danger. I don't think that probably until the last 30 years we've thought about that in our society. You know, we've always thought of America as a Christian nation. We've always thought about this as a Christian society. It's never been absolutely true by any stretch of the imagination. But we've thought about it that way because the Bible was honored. God was honored. Our laws at base are laws that come from Bible values and Bible principles and Bible laws. We've always honored the Bible as being that on which we lay our hand before we do jury service or before we testify. We've honored God and His Word in a whole variety of ways throughout our government and our society as a whole. But we know that within our time, within our lifetimes, that's been eroding significantly. And we know that what used to be a uniculture of godliness, Jehovah God, has been multicultural now. And there's all different kinds of religions that have come into play. And now we're in a time in which everything is supposed to be equal, of equal value, of equal truth, of equality in every fashion. And we're struggling with it. All of us are struggling with it, no matter what we believe, no matter who we believe in. Assimilation into this universal culture is what we're expected now to become part of. And as Christians, we say no. We cannot in all good conscience, because what we believe to be truth has absolutes to it and has limits. And we believe that what God says is truth. And we either abide by that or we end up like the ancient Jews. And so the culture is no longer one that even accommodates us, much less is in agreement with us. But now it stands in so many ways opposed to us. Now we must fight assimilation. What is at stake is a clearly godly identity. Christians must never allow our identity to be compromised by a God-dishonoring culture. And that is what increasingly it seems we're facing. One scholar makes this comment: the depositioning of Christian faith in the West makes the community of the baptized a community now more fully dependent upon daily acts of imagination for the maintenance of identity. The daily acts evoking Christian identity are likely to be ethical as well as liturgic or worship. The beginning point is the recognition that serious identity is not a cultural given. We can no longer count on that, as in former times of domination when Christianity dominated our culture. But now is an oddness requiring courageous intentionality. It's simply to say that today, if we want to stand firmly, without wavering, without shame, for Christian identity, we have to do it intentionally and courageously. And that is what the Jews in captivity had to do as they faced a multicultural and a polytheistic empire and culture. We must do the impossible that God has called upon His faithful people to do. Trust fully in God's love and live by our faith in Him. Just as God's prophecy was proven true about a 70-year captivity and then a return to their homeland, so Christians must trust that God's prophecies about the return of His Son to take us home will be true. One of God's greatest promises to His people is that He will never abandon them. God has always been true to that promise. In the worst of times, and there were many awful times, when God's people were utterly unfaithful to Him, God was always absolutely faithful to them. It's a hallmark of God. It's so much a part of His character that cannot be divorced from Him. It's who He is. In their most difficult times, the ancient Jews could hold on to that promise. God would not abandon them. And so can we, if we are one of His people. Are you? If we can help you to become one, we urge you to come forward right now as we stand and sing.